You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine Number 78, To Live and Die in L.A., and the unhinged cinema of Billy Friedkin, featuring convicts, cops, priests, demons, truck drivers, counterfeiters, serial killers, killer trees, military men, bugs, fried chicken, and bad boy Billy Peterson. Martin.
Yes.
Uncle Sam, don't care about your expenses. You want bread? Fuck a baker.
To live and die in L.A., California.
What you say about Los Angeles? Still the only place for me.
It never rains in the sun.
To live and die in L.A., where every day we try to fatten our pockets. Us niggas hustle for the cash, so it's hard to knock it. Everybody got their own thing coming, see chasing worldwide through the hard times, worrying faces. Shed tears as we bury niggas close to heart. What was a friend, now a ghost in the dark. Cold part about it, nigga got smoked by a fiend. Trying to floss on him, blind to a broken man's dream. A hard lesson, court cases keep him guessing. Plea bargain ain't an option now, so I'm stressing. Cost me more to be free than a life in the pen. Making money off of cuss words, writing again. Learn how to think ahead, so I fight with my pen. Late night, down sunset, like in the sin. What's the worst they can do to a nigga? Got me lost in hell to live and die in L.A. on bail. My angels sing.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, William Friedkin, where does he kind of rank for you in terms of like all-time directors?
Pretty high for a few films. Watching a lot of his filmography, like I like them all, not all of them are my favorites, but like the heights of like after Gene Hackman passed away, I rewatched French Connection then, and then my girlfriend's a huge Exorcist fan, so that came on, watched it a couple weeks ago as well, and it's like, and obviously, and my personal favorite, Sorcerer. It's like, holy shit. I mean, like, the heights this guy was able to hit. I'm also fascinated by him because of the extra-textual conversations.
Oh, my God. Totally chill human being.
Yeah, just a really nice, and it for me, it really started with, I liked those movies, and then it was the summer of, like, 08, I think, I read Easy Rider's Raging Bull.
Right.
Easy Rider's Raging Bulls by Peter Biskind, and, like, there's that whole chapter basically on Friedkin and how he's a psychopath. Especially yeah. At that point was a complete psychopath. But for you, where is he in the pantheon?
I think that he embodies New Hollywood possibly better than anyone we've discussed thus far. Like, when I think of the New Hollywood, I think of French Connection, I think of Sorcerer. I even think, even though it's at the end of it, Cruising.
Yeah.
Like, he made some of these movies that, like, were the true kind of epitome of renegade filmmaking, even though, like, he was making them for the studios, which might actually make them more New Hollywood than anything, because like he was making French Connection for
Paramount,
Warner Brothers, right?
You're right. I think it's Warner Brothers. Yeah.
And then, you know, he makes The Exorcist for Warner Brothers. He makes Sorcerer, and like, there's also obviously the stigma attached to him, to Sorcerer in particular, is that, you know, he made one of the great films of all time that was trounced by Star Wars. You know, it comes out the same weekend as Star Wars, and that's the reason why that movie kind of monumentally failed. But it's like, when you watch his movies, and again, when you take in even the stuff that he tells about himself, because like, Friedkin was one of the great storytellers to come out of that time, like him and Coppola, I would probably say, and Scorsese.
But I was going to say Coppola was the one I'd put as having a very similar arc within the 70s.
Yeah, as just these hotshot maverick kid who came in, made these movies for, you know, these big studios, was doubted the entire way, and then basically became like the biggest movies ever. Because like, let's face it, we talk about Jaws a lot as being one of the movies that completely changed cinema and the way that movies were released and the blockbuster format and like people lining up around the blocks to go see it. But like, Exorcist was before that.
Yeah, yeah, 2 years, yeah.
And people talk about The Exorcist in terms of, like, you know, I waited in line for 3 showings until I finally got in and got to see what people were touting as, like, the scariest movie ever. I mean, my dad tells me this story. It's one of his, like, infamous pieces of, like, dad lore, you know, is that when he was playing basketball in college, I believe for the University of Richmond, he and one of his teammates went to see The Exorcist, and they were so scared by it that my dad literally moved his dresser in front of his door when he went to sleep that night because he was scared that the devil was going to come in and try to get him in his bedroom. To which point, I always looked at my dad and was like, Dad, did you think the devil couldn't move the dresser? Like, I'm pretty sure
he is unsound.
He would throw that aside like a fucking Lego set. And my dad's like, I wasn't a smart man. I played fucking basketball in college. He's like, that's why I was at the University of Richmond. I didn't get an academic
scholarship.
This
is all very your dad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, Friedkin, unlike Coppola, like Coppola obviously made mega hits with the Godfather films and also like critical smashes with The Conversation and stuff. But like with Friedkin came in and kind of revolutionized and remade in his own image movies that we had seen a million times before, because the most, like, we'll put it this way, is like the most radical cop movie before French Connection to come out of Hollywood was probably what? Bullet with Steve
McQueen? Or In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night. Well, I'm thinking more formally.
Like cop movie, yeah.
Dirty Harry would be another one.
Right, well, because Bullet definitely has a new Hollywood vibe of that very realistic. It was the
car chase.
The car, well, even the way they shot it was like a lot of zoom lenses. Already kind of that style. The cinema verite they were kind of borrowing from overseas.
Right.
And bring into the new Hollywood, right?
Yeah, and then like Don Siegel making Dirty Harry with a lot of those long zooms and everything too. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, like French Connection still felt, because of Friedkin's previous documentary work, it had this very man on the street kind of vibe. And also, you know, in A Decade Under the Influence, the Ted Demme's like kind of monumental new Hollywood documentary, you know, Roy Scheider tells a story too about going and seeing The French Connection more or less in like a Harlem movie theater, I believe, or maybe it was Brooklyn. It was a New York movie theater. Went and saw it with a mostly black audience and was sitting there and kind of started sinking in his seat because he knew the one infamous line from the movie that was coming up to when, you know, they chase that black suspect down the alleyway.
Yeah.
He comes after them. They persevere, and then they get back to the station, and, you know, Scheider looks at Gene Hackman and is like, what was that? And Hackman looks at me and goes, never trust a N-word.
Yeah.
And Scheider was like, I was expecting the theater to explode in, like, and like black people to basically revolt because we put the N-word and we had this white guy saying it. And they actually started cheering because it was such a realistic depiction of how they knew cops to be in New York.
Right.
And that was the thing, is that,
like, they got it right.
Friedkin was the one who was basically coming in and bringing like the great cop movie consultants in, like Randy Jurgensen, who we've talked about before, who also worked, you know, with Bill Lustig on like Maniac and movies like that, and has been in like a million movies too. You know, Randy Jurgensen came in and was the one who was basically making sure that it was all completely accurate. And Friedkin would go to him and be like, hey, in this scene, like, is this the way you would do it? Essentially, is this the way you would interrogate a suspect? Is this the way that you would cuff a suspect? Is this a way that, like, you would engage in a pursuit? And Jurgensen would give him these little, to use my favorite term, texture notes, so that it all felt authentic. And I feel like that's, for The French Connection, that's what makes it so radical, is that you watch it and it feels like a movie made by a cop, even though Friedkin is not at all.
Yeah, I
was an intellectual.
I rewatched it with my mom. My dad had just had his knee surgery and I was home in Indiana. And I was like, it was when we were doing the episode for Gene Hackman, like I said. And I was like, Mom, I need to watch French Connection. It's been years. Do you mind if we pop it on? And she goes, oh, I haven't seen it since it came out. My parents were living in Scotland. They saw it in the theater, you know, but they just saw everything that came, you know.
Right.
Newlyweds. They got married in 70. And my mom, who's much more like, she likes to be on her phone. Like, she's more like, she does a lot of stuff while she's watching a movie.
Right.
She was fucking.
She's a second screener.
Yeah.
As it were.
But she was locked in on French Connection. And she's like.
Hard not to be.
But she goes, I forgot how great this is. And I was like. And I was, even me, like, I hadn't seen it in a few years. I own it. But I was just like, holy shit. Like, this movie crackles. It gives it, like, and this is fucking, what, 54 years ago.
Right.
But to your point, I think what's really interesting to talk about Jaws and then talk about French Connection and Exorcist is, like you said, a lot of the most successful films in the new Hollywood were taking B plots and making them with an A budget, right?
Right.
With A quality, right? And so you have a cop movie, you have a, you know, it could have been a Corman movie, a demon movie, right? You have Sorcerer Truck Drivers, you know, it could have just been a Corman movie as well, just like how you could have done it completely schlockily. You know,
even though it's a remake of Wages of Fear.
Agreed. But he's
one of the great French movies of all time.
No, agreed. You know, but at the same time, though, the way I think it was like released, it's like an action movie. It's a big adventure.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, Friedkin, like you said, like he brought that more than many people that. Like very similar to some of the shots again, especially the surveillance stuff and conversation of that zoom lens. I think for me, like no one does two things better than Friedkin, especially at this era, is a tracking running shot that locks the character in the middle of the frame and a car chase that makes you feel like I think someone's going to die.
This is unsafe.
And it started with French Connection. You see it again when we get to Live and Die in L.A. Or even some of the stunt stuff, even in The Hunted with Del Toro. You're like, wait, what? Like, he seems the kind of guy who's like, I don't care, just make it happen.
Well, you know? Sorcerer 2 is
Sorcerer.
He also tells those, like, stories about, like, you know, production was delayed because a giant tree fell on the track in the middle of the Amazonian jungle. And the only way that he knew in order to, you know, clear that track is that he just happened to know an arsonist from his days in Brooklyn and called him down. And the guy came down and basically blew the tree up because he was doing, I believe, insurance fraud in Brooklyn at the time, to where, like, if guys, you know, were going bankrupt on, like, say, their department store or whatever, you know, they would call this arsonist and basically have him work his magic, burn the place down, and then collect the insurance money and give him, like, a percentage of the payout for it. This is the story at the very least. So Sorcerer, for me, when I first moved here and they did that restoration of Sorcerer and
he was
kind of traveling around the country.
The 4K, right?
Yeah. Friedkin came to the Ritz and they did a double feature of the restoration of Sorcerer on the big screen and then To Live and Die in L.A. on 35mm.
Oh, fuck me.
And Friedkin came. I saw Friedkin twice in person, both at the Draft House, once at the Ritz and once at South Lamar. And he did his whole raconteur thing to where he just got up there with that big, blustery voice of God, you know, that came out of this man, even as he, you know, got into his 80s and stuff, is that, like, he could just tell a story and you would be so enraptured with what he had to say, even though you knew in the back of your head that he was a real print the legend type. Like, there's some embellishment going on. There was some blustery, you know, self-mythologizing happening.
Yeah.
But there was also, like, enough detail to where you're like, this, you probably embellished this, but, like, it's true. And, like, you just seemed like the type of dude, like, for Cruising, you know, he would talk about that he knew one of the big mafia bosses in New York who owned all of the gay clubs. And that was how he was basically able. He went to this mafia boss and was like, hey, you know, I want to make this movie about the gay leather clubs. Is there any way that we can get in there and film and explore and do research? And that's how he was basically given permission to do it. He just had this personal relationship. But again, the texture comes through in Cruising because, like, you're in those fucking gay clubs. You're watching a guy get fisted. Like, you're seeing it, and it doesn't feel unrealistic. Like, it feels like that's what 42nd Street and those hot zones in New York felt like in the early 80s and the pre-AIDS kind of early 80s when, like, sex was wild and free inside of the gay community.
Yeah, and it's
that Fred Halstead era.
Well, and it's interesting because to your point about, you know, like, using all, you know, blowing up a tree or having a mafia boss friend, like, he had these workarounds, is a lot of the brilliance of him and the also assholiness of him was a very, like, I have an idea and I'm going to do it, right?
Right.
And he was a very, now, where that got complicated, like you said, like, it's very clean and self-mythologized. And again, reading Biskin's book, Easy Rise, Raging Bulls, and there's a whole chapter specifically, it comes back on the production of Sorcerer. And I remember Biskin kind of putting Sorcerer as, like, the beginning of the end of the new Hollywood. Because
of the Star Wars trouncing.
Well, that plus just the production. Like, it was... Yeah.
It was a Heaven's Gate style kind of failure.
Hundreds of days over budget. You know, and it's funny to have Scheider go from Jaws, which was a huge success, but a very difficult production.
Right.
That Scheider's in the middle of and starring in and on a fucking waterlogged boat and his gun won't fire. And you watch the behind the scenes for that. He's already having a rough time. Comes back for his friend who's worked with before Friedkin to do Sorcerer, who's coming off Exorcist. So two guys coming off two of the biggest films of all time.
Yeah.
And they come on, they're in the middle of the jungle. And, you know, famously, Friedkin would fire the whole crew.
Right.
Like, he would say everyone's fired except the actors. And then finally, I think it was like he'd done it three times. And, like, Scheider's like, Billy, I love you. We can't make a movie without the crew. Like, you can't.
Yeah.
You got to stop firing everyone. And so the movie, watching it, and again, my favorite Friedkin film, is a miracle. But at its core, beyond that insanity, like Coppola doing, I think, you know, Sorcerer and Apocalypse Now are great, just a pair, you know, these two guys literally in the jungle coming off hugely successful early careers, kind of like these wunderkinds, and they're going to go, I'm going to make the most important crazy movie of all time.
I mean, the very definition of blank check movie.
Yes, like 100%.
You had massive success. You're allowed to basically do whatever the fuck you want.
Which was the dark side of the new Hollywood, right?
Right.
That was the... There's got to be an end to this. If you give complete creative control to these young 20-something, early 30 filmmakers.
Real maverick types.
Maverick, intelligent, you know, for the most part, men. And you're saying, go for it. You haven't lost yet. I don't know why I wouldn't quit betting on you, right?
Right.
And then they both, and you know, it's a miracle that Apocalypse Now, A, was finished, and B, was a success. But based on everything we know of that production.
I mean, all you have to do is watch Eleanor Coppola's Hearts of Darkness. And it's madness.
How did it even get finished? You know, let alone be coherent.
I mean, Coppola almost died.
Yeah.
Martin Sheen almost died.
Yeah, yeah. And so I put Friedkin in that boat of, you know, he was at the same time, this is probably pretentious, but this guy was able to conjure some of my favorite shots in cinematic history.
Oh, sure.
Because, I mean, for me, you know, with Sorcerer, the scene on the bridge, I will show it to people who've never seen that movie.
Can't figure out how he did it.
Because it's unsafe. There's just no way it was unsafe.
He just did it.
I mean,
that is the answer. He had a rickety bridge. He had a fucking truck. He had to get it across in the middle of this massive storm. That's how he did it.
Yeah.
He just did it because he risked life and limb of basically everybody involved.
Everyone.
Which, if you did that now, that's the one thing you have to talk about with William Friedkin, is that it's like, we lionize this guy, but, like, he's also the dude who, like, post Me Too and post kind of cancel culture and stuff, like, we go back and you have to re-examine some of his behavior through that lens of, like, you know, at the very end when the priest is giving the last rites over Father Kerrigan after he goes down the steps in Georgetown in The Exorcist. And Father Karras, I'm sorry. And, you know, he's giving the last rites and his hands are shaking in the cold. His hands are shaking because freaking slapped him in the face to get the take the way he wanted. Imagine if you heard about fucking Ari Aster slapping an actor, slapping Joaquin Phoenix would probably welcome it.
Yeah.
But, you know, slapping Austin Butler or something. And we found out he would never make another movie again. Well, nobody would allow it.
Well, and The Exorcist was, you know, the definition of controlled insanity. He would fire a gun just to get people tense behind on the stage. And the famous story, the shot that they left in the movie of when Reagan backhands her mother and Ellen Burstyn hits the wall and screams, she literally slipped a disc in that shot in the movie. And she, on the documentary, she's like, I will never work with that fucking asshole again.
Yeah. There, as many people who love him hate him.
Yeah.
To where they recognize that he's a complete fucking maniac. Pacino infamously hated his performance and hated working with him on Cruising.
He's amazing in it, though.
Because is he amazing?
I love Pacino in that movie.
I don't know. I love Paul Sorvino.
I don't know what it is. This time it clicked for me, and it feels uncomfortable in the right way.
So that part I can agree with. I struggle with Pacino's performance in Cruising because I genuinely think, and maybe what you're picking up on uncomfortable, I'm picking up as being unsure. Like, it feels like a guy who doesn't quite get the movie that he's in and doesn't like the working environment, obviously, that Friedkin's kind of created. Now, side note, can you imagine what the original version of Cruising would have looked like?
Who was it?
Spielberg. It was in...
What?
Yeah, in Shock Value.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Jason Zeidman, he has a little aside about how in the 70s, right around the time that I believe it might be pre-Jaws, but he was going down into New York and hanging out in the leather clubs with De Palma and Margot Kidder.
Wait, Spielberg was?
Yeah, to do research to make Cruising. He wanted to make Cruising.
Was it a novel or just was it a script that was floating around?
It was a novel that was adapted. I've never read it, but by all accounts, it's a very loose, adaptation because
there were a lot of those in the New Hollywood.
Well, because the majority of it is based on a real case by Randy Jurgensen when he went undercover in the gay clubs to basically try and hunt down a serial killer. It's also based partially on the technician who's in The Exorcist who actually did kill a guy and dismember him and toss him in the Hudson. You never knew that?
I forgot about that.
It's in Mindhunter. It's in Mindhunter, too.
Oh, yeah.
They actually do the whole storyline where the two FBI profilers go in and talk to him and talk to how he was an extra in The Exorcist and everything. And he killed and dismembered a man and dumped him in the river. And that's how they find him in trash bags. That's where the opening shots come from in Cruising, is that Friedkin actually had this guy work as the technician in the background. This is pre-murders and everything before all that. And then he got convicted of murder, got sentenced, I believe, to life in prison. And Friedkin actually went and interviewed him and talked to him again and talks about how he sat down with this guy being like, hey, when I had met you, you seemed like a pretty decent dude, more or less. What happened? You know what I mean? But again, it's another bit of Friedkin self-mythologizing to where he takes credit for it, but how much of it was that he just happened to cast a real medical x-ray technician in the background of the Reagan test scenes in the middle of Exorcist, and that guy just happened to kill somebody, and then it was inspiration. And also, again, as we're talking about his methods and stuff, how many people in modern times would stand for a major director being I cast a murderer, he went to prison, like, granted, the first one is by accident, but then I went and interviewed him and got inspiration for a second movie and made that as part of the narrative for Cruising. Like, a lot of people would be like, I don't know, man, that might be unethical.
The thing that keeps coming up as we're talking about him is, have you no shame, right? People right, would yeah, say,
exactly.
You know, and it's like, my favorite freaking story, and there are obviously many, again, from Biskin's book, is Friedkin worked on Alfred Hitchcock Presents. One of his first directing jobs, narratively, was doing an episode of, like, similar to, like, Spielberg did Night Gallery, right?
Right.
A lot of these guys cut their teeth on these anthology series. And,
well, and he also made the documentary The People versus Paul Crump.
Yeah.
That actually freed a wrongfully convicted man.
Yeah, so he was kind of working. Well,
and then he went into TV because of that.
Yeah, but he's also working both sides, right? Of, like, he's doing narrative and he's doing these, like, hard-hitting, like, you know, socially conscious documentaries. But the story I remember was, because it was, I guess, late 60s at this point, and it's really much a clashing of generations, as Spielberg would famously come often to the set of his show. Not all the time, but he would
right.
want to meet the young filmmakers and kind of and be adored. And Hitchcock always wore a suit. And, you know, Hitchcock comes on in his black and white suit, you know, white shirt, black tie. And Friedkin's doing his wearing like a young, you know, upstart. He's got a white t-shirt, jeans, and like a Converse on, you know, and he's in the middle in his long, shaggy hair and his dark glasses. And, you know, Friedkin walks up. He's like, oh my God, Mr. Hitchcock, it's just an honor to meet you. And Hitchcock goes, in my time, we wore suits to work. And Friedkin's like, all right. So years later, he wins the Oscar for, I believe it's for when he wins for French Connection. And then when they would be at tables still at the Oscars, and he walks by Hitchcock's table where and Friedkin is wearing a tuxedo, and he flicks his bow tie and goes, how do you like the suit, Hitch? And then walks up and gets the Oscar. Like, he's such an asshole that he's a dick to maybe the greatest filmmaker in the history of cinema. Like, he has, there's no line for him. Right. And that makes him also charming.
Well,
at the same time.
Yeah. Cause it's, for part of the preparation for this episode, I watched a documentary on him called Friedkin Uncut, which is mostly just one long ass interview where he talks about the majority of his, the thing that, and we'll get into it as we kind of go along with his filmography, is that the one thing I was disappointed with on the documentary is that, like, it really only hit on the big ones. It was like French Connection, Exorcist, Sorcerer, Cruising, To Live and Die in LA. And then it kind of skips past the 90s, which were a weird kind of no man's land for him, and goes straight to the Tracy Letts adaptations of Bug and Killer Joe. But, like, in the middle there, and you kind of hinted at this in the beginning, is that, like, so after To Live and Die in LA, which I swear to our audience we'll eventually get to,
we can't ignore everything else.
You know, he in the 90s makes Rampage, which, have you ever seen his serial killer movie,
Rampage? I couldn't even find a copy of it.
Well, it's coming out finally on a restored edition from Kino Lorber, and they're giving you both.
Because I like Michael Biehn a lot.
Copies.
So, yeah.
Well, the only way I had ever seen, I know that there's a torrent of, like, because it's weird, there's two versions of it. There's one that's like a producer's version that I believe the story goes, the production company ran out of money and released an inferior cut, and then Friedkin came back years later and recut it and did it that way. I might be getting the facts on that wrong, but something happened where there's two cuts of the movie and one is Friedkin's preferred version. Here's the thing. Neither version, that great. Interesting movie because it's another serial
it's
killer
also a queer,
film.
Queer killer as well.
Queer yeah. serial killer movie where within an attorney kind of interrogating why this guy is the way he is doesn't quite work, but it's still worth watching. But then there's also The Guardian, which is the weird, I like The Guardian. It's a piece of shit.
I enjoyed it this time. I've seen it like three times and this was a fun one,
but like, it's a real schlocky horror movie about a nanny sacrificing babies to like a druid tree god.
Yeah.
If I recall correctly.
But also has insane gore.
Yeah, the gore is crazy.
When the rapist guys get impaled by all, it's like, what?
Well, and they start cutting into the tree and there's like guts inside of it and stuff.
Very
like,
Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. I mean, and then he did Blue Chips, which I personally think might be, you know what? No, it's not might be. Blue Chips is the best movie from the 90s from Billy Friedkin.
Undoubtedly.
Like, which to me, but when you watch it now, and you know anything about college sports has also aged incredibly poorly, both because, you know, Nick Nolte is more or less doing Bobby Knight.
He's just doing it.
Yeah. And Bobby Knight has since been canceled for numerous wrongdoings and behind the scenes.
Well, a perfect subject for Friedkin, though, of a very, like,
difficult
it,
man.
Just get it done.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes, get it done, right? And I am not, for our listeners, that's not how I am, but it's just you look at these guys and it's like, at what cost?
I mean, dude, I'm going to tell you, like, I was pro Bobby Knight for years because Bobby Knight was one of my grandfather's best friends.
No shit.
Yeah.
I'm from Indiana, so I grew up with, like, his tenure.
Yeah, like the Hoosiers and stuff. Like, Bobby Knight was a legend in my household. Like, my dad used to refer to him as Uncle Bobby because,
holy
like,
shit, I never knew that.
Yeah, he knew my grandfather. Harold Horse Taylor was the winningest coach in Western Pennsylvania history for basketball. And he just knew Bobby Knight very, very well.
Yeah.
Anyway, the point being, like, Bobby Knight for a long time there was like a hero to many college basketball fans because sort of in the same way, like you just said with William Friedkin, is he represented a very old school ideal of what a hard-nosed, no bullshit college coach was supposed to be. But then also you look back and watch the old like post-game interviews where like he would get criticized for his tactics and stuff. And he literally brought, you know, a bullwhip to one, you know, press conference and started dipping it in water and being like, I like to keep the ends wet when I whip the boys. And it's like, he's fucking around. But if anybody did that now, they would be like, well, guess you never coach anywhere ever again. But the other thing that has really dated Blue Chips is just the notion of paying players in the NCAA and how that's, you know, in the 90s and stuff, that was a hot button topic with, like, you know, coaches like Rick Pitino and John Calipari and things like that. One of my dad's least favorite people on the planet. To where, you know, to win, you had to cheat. You had to pay players. You had to give them cars. You had to buy them their mom's houses and stuff. And that's the big conflict of the movie is Nick Nolte being the upright college coach who represents winning the old school way at just like developing players and turning them into like good men, to where you had JT Walsh, the great JT Walsh, you know,
he's in every movie I've watched lately.
He's like,
I watched Backdraft. I watched fucking Needful Things.
He's honest to God, just in the pantheon of the great American character actors of all time. Like if you needed a heel, and, like, you just went and got JT Walsh.
Probably the nicest guy in the world, too. Like, but, you know, he just came in and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just an incredible fucking actor, though, too. Like, even in, like, something like A Few Good Men, where he comes in for his few scenes and just becomes, like, the whistleblower and that, and then blows his brains out at the end. He's great. But also Breakdown with Kurt Russell.
Oh, dude, I think it's his best role.
All-timer JT Walsh performance. Because
it's his biggest role, probably. He's, like, the real, like... villain of that movie.
Well, and him being the slimy head of the boosters for this fake university and Blue Chips, like that's where the conflict comes from, and it's all about Happy butting up against Nick Nolte's coach, and it's like, and the movie really does become an interrogation of morality. You know, and it's like, and what happens when a guy, an old school guy, sells his soul in the name of money and winning and everything. And like, dude, Nolte in that movie is so fucking good.
Well, has there ever been a better casting than Nick Nolte playing Bobby Knight?
Yeah.
Like, they're just made to,
when,
like,
he's kicking the balls like Bobby Knight would in the middle of games. And like, but that final press conference that he gives is so heartbreaking when you literally watch a man it becomes the thing that Friedkin loves so much, is that like so many of his movies become these theatrical confessions of the soul of these like very difficult men wrestling with their own morality, or even anti-morality sometimes in the case of like French Connection and To Live and Die in LA, is that like these guys were often amoral or compromised their morals in the name of like pursuing a villain or victory itself. And like Nolte just, it almost becomes like Greek tragedy when he breaks down in front of this like throng of reporters who want nothing to do but like completely hold this guy up as a champion, and he knows in his heart that he's not. It's like, it's one of Nolte's, for me, one of his most undervalued performances, because watching it again, I was like, damn, this movie's flawed, and like Penny Hardaway can't fucking act. But no. Like, but Shaq is actually pretty charismatic.
Well, he knew how to use him too. I think freaking knew how to use him. But I remember this came out in Indiana. We all lost it.
Yeah.
We were like, oh, because
this was one of my dad's favorite movies.
Well, because Hoosiers is just like, you could buy Hoosiers at McDonald's in Indiana. Like, it was that to like forever. It was always like, there's this VHS. And then when Blue Chips came out, it was like, stop the fucking presses.
Yeah.
It was like the sequel to Hoosiers. People were calling it, as I remember.
And then after Blue Chips, though, you get Jade, which it's almost him trying to return to like his cop movie roots of French Connection and To Live and Die in LA. And like,
but again, he's like, I'll do my basic instinct with Joe Esterhaz.
Yeah. Joe Esterhaz writes the script. It's like, it comes in the wake of Basic Instinct and Sliver Fatal and Attraction, everything. Fatal Attraction. And it is him melding like an erotic thriller with his cop movie, but like, it's not good.
No,
it does have a great, super intense David Caruso performance. I mean, it does also have the legendary line of "It was a fuck house," which is one of the funniest deliveries of all time. But it's bad. And then like the 2000s roll along, and there's some good stuff.
I like The Hunted.
I like The Hunted. I like Rules of Engagement.
Yep, me too.
Like as his courtroom thrillers, because that's the other thing, is he liked a courtroom drama. Like Rampage is technically a courtroom drama for the most part. He does 12 Angry Men as like a TV movie, you know, with Jack Lemmon at a certain point, which is really, really good.
And George C. Scott.
Yep. Rules of Engagement is mostly a courtroom drama, you know, again, putting on an upright man who compromised his morals in a moment of like extreme duress with Samuel L. Jackson. And it's also one of the early Guy Pearce roles, where Guy Pearce plays the upright prosecutor kind of going after him.
Right after he did L.A. Confidential.
Exactly. Yeah. And then one of his final, his actual final film is the Caine Mutiny Court Martial, which is, you know, that's one thing that we're going to have to talk about, is that like there are these little pockets inside of William Friedkin's filmographies where he's just doing stage plays as movies. I mean, some of his early, productions are like The Birthday Party, the Harold Pinter play, you know, The Night They Raided Minsky's, The Boys in the Band, these kind of radical stage adaptations that he brought to the screen, but then which are, he returns to at the end when he kind of struggles to get money to make movies again, but then he starts making Tracy Letts plays, to where he makes Bug and my personal favorite, Killer Joe, which I think I will go on record as saying, I think that's Matthew McConaughey's best performance. I love him so much in that movie, and that movie's fucking deranged.
I remember seeing it. So my really good friend, Steve, in Atlanta, we would see everything together when I lived there, and we went to film school together, and we saw, we go, hey, you want to go see the White Ribbon? You want to see Haneke? We're like, and we'd see everything, right?
Right.
We saw Amore, and then when Killer Joe came out, I was like, guys, we gotta fucking go. And we went to the Terra Theater, which used to be a porn theater in Atlanta. That's where they show all the indie stuff. And we were just like slack-jawed watching that movie, like, because I saw Bug as a double feature with Knocked Up. They came out the same weekend.
Jesus.
With my brother in 07.
Talk about polar opposites of feeling.
And I liked them both. And I was like, I like Knocked Up. And I was like, and Bug, and again, we were texting about it. I think one of the things we can't forget with Friedkin is kind of your staying with Guy Pearce is here's this guy with an eye for talent.
Oh, yeah.
Too. Because I think that's the first film, that and then Shotgun Stories, where I see Michael Shannon and I was like, he's weird looking. He's got that, he's kind of wall-eyed. All this kind of, he's like, is he handsome? I don't know. But he is so amazing. And then Ashley Judd, who's not the person you would imagine headlining.
Who'd be able to get to that level of darkness.
But her monologue, I mean, she does the monologue. Yeah. Which I have some female actresses friends who said, like, they use that as their audition monologue. And obviously Tracy Letts fucking rules.
Oh, yeah. Know?
And so the writing's so good. But Friedkin, we can't forget that while he's an asshole, he's an actor's director, and he knows how to balance a scene and get a performance from people that you wouldn't expect. And like you said, with I would agree. I mean, my favorite McConaughey is always True Detective. It just will be. I can't top it.
Yeah, sure.
But for a film, I would agree it's got to be Killer Joe, because I think it is the weird answer, strangely, to Texas Chainsaw Next Generation. Early in his career, he doesn't know what he's doing, but he's still wild, and it's like that director didn't know how to use him. But I'm like, wow, this guy's interesting. I like him.
He's the best part of that movie.
He's 100%. And then he comes back, and it's like now with all his power, but pre-McConaissance. You know, this is before it's Dallas right Buyers Club. Right at the
beginning.
But right before, people were talking about it, though. Like,
yeah.
It's True Detective, it's Dallas Buyers Club, but for me are the two where people are like, this is the guy. But Killer Joe is like a showstopper. Specifically, I mean, the fried chicken scene is...
The fried chicken scene and everything with Juno Temple.
Oh, no, I was going to say, that's when she pulls her shirt up. That film makes me feel icky.
Oh, yeah.
I feel... And no one's captured like trailer park life in a more...
It's so white trash.
Dingy.
But then again, so is Bug. Bug's very white trashy. Like, and Michael Shannon even has that great monologue too about the machines and hearing the machines in his head and everything. And like, but for me, I like Killer Joe more because it's way more of a black comedy. Like, it's just, and it gets so unhinged by the end, where when he's beating the shit out of Emile Hirsch.
Oh, God.
And like, also.
He's also great in this.
He's also great. Thomas Hayden Church has never been dopier in his whole life. Like, it's Gina Gershon, even though she's like gnarly in this movie, I still look at her and I'm like, damn, Gina Gershon.
Mm-mm-mm. She's got a thing.
But like, it also, it has one of the great final lines of all time, too, of I'm pregnant. And what that reveal and the way that movie ends, and that he just drops stroking at the end of it as, like, the end credits song. Like, freaking and you know saw me, the humor.
That's my karaoke song.
Yeah, I've seen you numerous times do stroking in front of bars that I've run.
Yeah, and people who don't want to hear it, but I will do it every time until I die.
And it's just an incredible movie, but it's also... At its core, and to take it back to Live and Die in L.A. so we can finally talk about this movie, is that, like, again, one of Friedkin's biggest fascinations is with unlikable main characters, guys who are just completely fucked up beyond any kind of repair. And that's where, you know, William Peterson's Secret Service agent in To Live and Die in L.A. comes into play. So my most controversial opinion is I think To Live and Die in L.A. is Friedkin's best movie. I think hands down, just as a work of craft, as a work of storytelling, as just the action in it, the violence in it, the gore in it when dudes are getting shot in the face with shotguns. It's also, to be fair, the most Jacob Knight-coded of all of his films, the wild neon, the cocaine sweaty kind of palm vibe to it, that car chase in the middle, like the Wang Chung, like synth score. Like, it's just, if there's a movie that's more me in his catalog, I don't think we've found it.
No, I got that 4K from Kino and it's gorgeous. And I showed it to Val and, like, this is pretty fucking great, you know?
Yeah.
And
it looks, the Robbie Mueller cinematography in it is just drop dead gorgeous.
Well, I remember how I came to it, because I, you know, while I do like Friedkin, obviously Michael Mann is my favorite director, and I'd seen Manhunter, and I think that's how I got, when I first saw Manhunter, I said, oh, there's another like similar era neon colored cop movie. And what an interesting pair of movies to watch. For real.
Right.
You know, because they're both, you could do frames from them and think they're almost the same movie.
Right.
With the Robbie Mueller, you know, cinematography, and then the Dante Spinotti cinematography, right?
Right.
And the color, and then even the, you could hear it, the music, everything. They couldn't be more different, you know, beyond that. Of, especially William Peterson's performance, you know, of, you see this malleable actor where in the hands of man, he's cold, he's calculating, he's driven, he's torn between...
Oh, he's a man protagonist.
He's a man protagonist. Yeah, he's torn between his vocation and his love, right? Done. And then you can watch, he's so much more complex in To Live and Die in L.A. And I will always prefer Manhunter. That's just, you know, I'll never switch. But watching this again, and it's one of, even on rewatch, it's one of the most surprising movies. Like, I think, and I showed it to Val, she goes, what the fuck?
Idiosyncratic, well, and the spoiler way the story alert, is structured.
Yeah, well, it's really choppy and weird, but purposefully.
Yeah.
You know, it really keeps you off balance the whole movie until your protagonist, again, spoiler alert, is shot in the fucking face. You know,
happens much later in the movie. That some people always try to say it's like halfway point, but it's like with 20 minutes left.
No,
but it is every time it happens, and I've seen it like probably 10 times at this point. Every time it happens, it's still shocking.
Yeah,
where you're just like, also because like it's surprising that he was allowed to get an R rating for this movie because the violence in it is so brutal.
There's also hard cock.
Yeah,
you see hard penis in this fucking movie.
Yeah, William shows his Peterson, man.
But it is like, right, and I think they probably, it's one of those things you're like, that's probably not unsimulated. Because like,
nah, he's just hard as fuck.
Yeah, like, come on.
He's just out there in these streets just swanging dong. He's not even hanging dong.
And he seems coked out too.
Well, that's like, that's the one thing about his movies that I think is so special too, that we haven't really hit on yet, is that they're all time capsules. In their own way. Like when you look at French Connection, like that's what 70s New York looked, felt, cold, smelled like. Like that's what it, like anybody who was around back then will tell you. They're like, you watched that movie and you're like, yeah, that was New York. That's what it looked like. Cruising, like, is what New York looked like in the early 80s, especially in that very niche community. Like, if you ever watch, you ever read, again, any of Bill Landis's Sleazoid Express stuff, or if you watch any of Fred Halstead's kind of, like, hardcore, arty pornography from that scene, like, it's almost indistinguishable when you watch Halstead's movies from, like, what these gay clubs look like inside of Cruising. And then when you get to Live and Die in L.A., like, that's what I would imagine L.A. in the mid-80s when everybody's just doing coke and listening to synth music and wearing wild pastels and dancing and going to art shows and stuff. Like, that's what this kind of time and city, like, felt like. And the other thing, too, is that, like, man, this is one of the earliest Willem Dafoe performances. And, like, his sexually ambiguous artist come counterfeiter Eric Masters is like my favorite freaking antagonist because he's so nasty, he's so violent, he's so, like, every time he's on screen, I think he's scarier in this than the fucking demon that he played in Streets of Fire or even as Bobby Peru in Wild at Heart. Like, because, like, he just kind of appears and slithers through scenes. But at the same time, Eric Masters is super sexy. Like, he finds, like, Friedkin finds that very amorphous, difficult to define sexuality about Willem Dafoe, and he capitalizes on it.
No, I agree. Watching it, you know, you have that early Dafoe era of that. I think, you know, it starts with The Loveless, right? The Bigelow film. And, you know, you get to Streets of Fire, which we both equally adore, right? But while he's a villain, he's like a comic book villain, right? You know, he's archetypal. This one, he's really hard to pin down, you know, because when you first see him, there's these moments, I'll agree with you, of almost like gender bending, but also like sexual fluidity.
Yeah.
Of when he first kisses his partner, she has that wig on, and it's from an angle where you think it's a guy.
Right.
Like there's, and I, every time I watch it, I'm like, oh, and he's doing it in that very Willem Dafoe, like wide mouth, like he's sucking her face off. And like the scene, I mean, the shot, it was funny. Val's friends are always like texting, like, hey, we're watching a movie. Here's a screenshot. Does Martin know what it is? And it was Willem Dafoe naked throwing cash into the fucking fire. I'm like, oh, it's Live and Die in LA. There's just these you know, inescapable images that he creates that Dafoe is sexy. But also in that, again, you think 80s, I think like David Bowie. It's almost like he's a Bowie character. Bowie could have played this part, right? If like he's sexual, he's scary, you can't pin him down. And
he's almost like an alien.
Yeah, he is. He's an alien. And he has those cheekbones. And you have, they build before you even meet him, this mythology around this character of like, we got to get Masters. We got to stop Masters.
Right.
And then obviously them just destroying his partner. It kind of off to the races in a really frightening scene.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, and also frankly, the other ones are like the supporting cast in this movie, John Turturro, and like one of his earliest scummiest roles, like that fucking chase through the airport.
Oh my God.
Is so incredible. Dean Stockwell showing up, like Steve James from all of the American Ninja and like canon movies.
Yeah, what a weird role for him.
Yeah. Like him showing up in it. It's just like, there's that great moment between him and, Willem Dafoe, to where like Willem Dafoe actually intimidates this massive black dude.
Well, there's, you know, it's interesting about Friedkin, and we're kind of talking around it, the idea of like he loves to deal with systems, right?
Right.
You know, and subcultures. So you have like when you see the detail of, you know, it's not, hey, I need an exorcism and the exorcist. It's like, we gotta talk to this guy. Like the realistic or yeah, before we even do that, here's all these tests we got to run. I'm going to show all the tests. And he does that with Live and Die in L.A. as well, as like these little connections of, all right, if you did want to get a guy killed in jail, how would you do that?
Right.
And if he didn't do it, what would happen then? He's going off on these tangents, right, that like you don't see in a lot of cop movies.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and to take it back to your comparison to Michael Mann, this feels like the research Michael Mann would do, too, to where he would go and talk to actual convicts and stuff and be like, hey, if like a guy was basically being a stool pigeon and was in holding, how would you get to him, more or less? And like, it also creates that wild paranoia inside. Like, Turturro is one of the underrated performances in this movie because he's so paranoid. He's so, like, edgy the entire time. He's got that very, like, skittish quality to him that only Turturro really knows how to channel. He's great, but he brings it from that New York vibe, but he transplants it into L.A., which is, like, he's really, really good. And also, like, Darlan Flugel in this is so fucking hot.
Oh yeah.
Like as Peterson's kind of inside info girl, like who's always going undercover and trying to find Masters for him, you know. And then even like the early scenes with like that terrorist bomber in the beginning is a really great just setup to like show you who these guys are. It reminds me of the multiple plot lines intros, like in Sorcerer, where you meet all these guys in different parts of the globe, and like Friedkin just knows how to essentially define these characters through action as opposed to like reams of dialogue. It's the things that our favorite filmmakers, the Michael Manns, the Walter Hills of the world, like, they don't have a guy show up and tell you who they are. They show you who they are through action.
No, it's crazy. I'm, you know, you've read, I'm working on a new draft of my script, and it's like, it's talky, you know? And it's like the confidence of these filmmakers to be able to like completely show you someone is early on without sometimes any dialogue is impressive, right? And really hard to do. But I was, you know, there was a point I didn't want to forget about when you're talking about like the beginning of Live and Die in L.A. is how many of these films start on a global scale and then go to America, right? You have the beginning in France in French Connection. You have Iraq
in The Exorcist. You have
also all, Rules of Engagement.
Yeah, oh, but we in all the places, like you said, the opening of Sorcerer. This idea that
the jungle intro stuff from Hunted.
Yeah, the story starts on a larger scale, and it's this idea of like almost like how Hitchcock did in like the that whole thing in Psycho of like the moving into the windowsill of the apartment.
Right.
It's like we're starting big and we're like moving in.
Yeah, he's closing the aperture as opposed to widening it.
Exactly. And I love, and you think about, I think he does it best in The Exorcist because while he shoots Iraq very realistically, it still feels very mythic and wild and weird. And all the, you know, the shot of one of my favorite shots is Max von Sydow almost getting hit by the carriage.
Yeah.
And or looking at the metal workers and the guy with the dead eye, the milky eye. It's like, oh my God, it's really mythic and scary. And you hard cut to Georgetown. And it's this, like, I think they're wintry era. Mm-hmm. It's cold and it's super realistic. And it's like, and also you're cutting from him finding the Pazuzu statue in Iraq. And it's like, there's wild things happening in our world, and you're safe in your little space
here. Or you think you are.
You think you're safe and comfortable, but it's coming, you know. And I think he uses that, like you said, we were talking about, a lot in all of his films. And we're gonna, and like, even I think we talked about offline when I was watching Live and Die in L.A. You know, it's a terrorist, like you said, who's doing this bombing at the beginning of Live and Die in L.A. So you're connecting again to the global scale. He's a global terrorist with a point to make. And then you narrow in on this L.A. like microscopic view.
Almost very small-time counterfeiter. Even though he works with a lot of big fish, it's like,
yeah,
it's this very specific criminal that's not like, he's not a Bond villain. He's not trying to take over the world. He's not trying to destroy anything. He's not trying to become rich. He's just doing his thing, selling his fake dollars, his funny money, and then doing his art and fucking his weird girlfriend and like, that's it. Like, that's his existence.
Yeah.
You want to get to questions?
Let's do it.
All right. Questions about 1985's To Live and Die in L.A. and the cinema of Wild Billy Friedkin. Martin, top three Friedkin, go.
Number one, as I said, Sorcerer. I just like, this movie is a showstopper. It's like Tangerine Dream score and the entire look of the movie, the fact that it looks like someone should have died every second is unstoppable for me. Exorcist is number two. I love this movie.
Remember when we saw that at Exhumed on 35?
Dude, it opened.
Yeah.
It was my first year there, and it was like the first film was Exorcist, and I was like, oh, this is what we're doing?
Yeah.
And 35, big fucking screen, and then that movie just fucking rips.
It's awesome.
Still. And
Why'd you just look at me like you wanted to fight me after you said that? You're like, it still rips, still. In case you fucking doubted it, Jacob.
No, and then I'm basic, dude. French Connection. I just gotta be honest. Those are my favorites. They're the three.
That's all right. Nobody expects a whole lot more from you.
So I'm gonna go fuck myself. Y'all have a great day.
I mean, I'm going to Live and Die in L.A. is one, Sorcerer number two, Exorcist three. Like, or, I mean, so here's the thing. I have a real soft spot. This is not going to surprise anybody in the least bit for Cruising.
Yeah, I mean, that almost popped into my third. So watching it recently, I love that movie.
It's such a tremendous, it's like, the one thing we don't talk about enough is that even when William Friedkin isn't making horror movies explicitly, he still is the best at making horror movies. Like, you know, Cruising is almost like a slasher just set in this NYC underworld. To Live and Die in LA's like violence, like gets to like splatter levels of gore when those dudes are getting shot in the face and stuff. And like, also Willem Dafoe's Criminal could almost be like a monster out
it's like
of
a vampire.
Yeah. He's incredible in it. Killer Joe has the same kind of vibe. Bug's
a horror movie.
Bug's more or less a horror movie. Rampage has horror movie like the overtones. The Guardian is a horror movie more or less. He's really, really great at that. So like that would be right outside. I love Killer Joe a whole lot. I love Blue Chips a whole lot. He's one of my guys. You know, he's right outside of the pantheon for me of like Cronenberg and Mann and Brian De Palma. Like, he'd be probably number four. Like, I have to admit, like, I revisit Friedkin's best movies more than most other directors because he's also just such an impeccable craftsman while feeling like he's kind of making it up the entire time along the way.
Well, there's a quality to him too, and there's a shot in Sorcerer for me where it's after the explosion in Israel and Tel Aviv, and it cuts to you're riding on the military transport with the 50 cal, and the Tangerine Dream score comes in.
Yeah,
and I'm watching it, and every time I see that, I go, "This is the greatest movie ever made." Like it hits, and there's times where he hits those highs, and Sorcerer, I mean, it's the top 10 favorite movie for me. Like it just like no one else can do it like that. And you said, I like the idea of making it up as he goes along, but he's got such a gut for like what looks good, you know? And
he's one of those dudes who's just born to make movies.
Yeah. Like Spielberg and that very
like
similar.
He gets it, or Paul Thomas Anderson or any of these guys. He's not a hyper intellectual like Cronenberg who just happened to stumble into making movies. I mean, or De Palma's another great example of a guy who just follows like his gut on like, this would look great on screen. Like, that's what I'm going to do. You know, notes be damned from any studio executives. This movie's going to look and feel exactly the way that I want it to feel because that's what I trust audiences want to see, for better or worse, you know? So, like, but Friedkin also, like, just has that very renegade feel to a lot of his movies to where it just, they feel unsafe. And it's some of my favorite that we talked about with like Bill Lustig's movies is that it's just like,
or even George Miller,
Miller, like, to where you're just like, damn, you sacrificed everything in the service of getting the shot. And that's, you know, again, would it fly these days? Probably not, but really who cares?
Well, and not to go too deep on it, but like, you know, in a time of like, I mean, Hollywood's always been at mitigating risk, but we're at a new level of that now.
Yeah,
with the inclusion of AI and completely just bowing to like what they think audiences want for an iconoclast like this to be out there. I miss that.
Yeah,
I think we both do, right?
Yeah, and we don't give a flying fuck into a rolling donut whether or not anybody agrees with us.
No, yeah.
So double feature,
I was thinking about doing, I got it. I was going to do The Exorcist with...
The Guardian.
No, I was going to do it with Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
You've been pushing this movie on me quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I know you're going to... I love this movie so much, but I put it together because it's two different ways...
Yeah.
Okay. One is a true new Hollywood horror movie. Like, Let's Scare Jessica to Death is a weird character-based, like,
little regional thing.
Regional New York actors, but released by Paramount, like,
closer to almost like a George Romero production than anything else.
Right. Very, yeah. It's like Martin, it feels similar to like that era. Or
Martin,
like,
or Hungry Wives, yeah, or The Season Crazies, of the Witch, or all that stuff. Yeah.
But it's one of my favorite horror movies because, and I, it's funny, there's that beautiful Vinegar Syndrome 4K, which I like. And it was shot on 16mm. I just love it. It just looks perfect. And I remember the first time I saw it with my buddy Derek, I was completely blown away, because the way I always describe it is, like, it's like a paperback you find at like a yard sale. You know, it just,
you've described this movie as that.
Yeah, but I think it's apt because it is this, like, really kind of incidental little, it's barely a horror movie. It's very character based. It's very hippie, like the 60s rolling into the 70s. But it's funny, I think, to pair.
Feels like it happens right down the block from Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, almost.
Yeah, or, I mean, and it's a really great, like, also, like, upper northeast, you know, out of the city kind of story. But I think it pairs well with Exorcist because there was this inclination for the kind of highbrow horror of the 70s to kind of try to elevate things. Kind of like how we talk about A24 today.
I was going to say, it's almost like Let's Scare Jessica to Death would be the A24 movie, while like The Exorcist would be a Warner Brothers movie, but it would be like,
honestly, Conjuring.
Something like, I was going to say Conjuring or even Sinners.
Yeah.
Like along the lines of like a major blockbuster versus like this very small, arty little horror movie.
Exactly. Or I think more in the vein of Exorcist, you have like films like The Omen, right? A blockbuster,
right?
Big budget horror movie. But I just want to watch that also because I like Let's Scare Jessica to Death, and I'm going to make you love it as much as I do.
I know. We're going to have an episode coming up devoted entirely to Let's Scare Jessica to Death.
It was like how I made us do the Boogans eventually, because I kept talking about it for like 4 years, and then we had to eventually do it.
And it's going to happen.
Yep.
Like, it's coming soon. I would just do To Live and Die in L.A. and Cruising. Like, it's like, to me, those are the two, like, French Connection will always be the landmark movie that Friedkin gave us in the early 70s. And also just the sheer audacity of delivering that and The Exorcist back to back is like a real game changer moment in like big budget cinema. But for me, I would watch Cruising and I would watch To Live and Die in L.A. because I just like the sleazy, coked up, horror movie laced vibes of both. To where, like, he takes this cop movie formula and just molds these weird niche little worlds around them in a way that I just love looking at. My only criticism is that I would want to find a cut of fucking Cruising that is the original cut of the movie, because the new remastered versions that are on the fucking Arrow discs change it. Like, there are music cues missing, and you know how like in the original version of Cruising it opens with all the boat stuff and everything, and it cuts to like the title, and the title scrolls across the screen. That's gone completely in the Arrow disc. Don't know why. What? Yeah, like they now it just has a still title card that says William Friedkin's Cruising. And I'm like, why the fuck would you do this? I love that opening title crawl. It's so ominous. It's so awesome. It looks incredible if you've ever seen it on the big screen. Like, to lose that just kind of loses a little bit of texture from the movie, for a movie that's almost entirely made up of texture.
Yeah.
And like,
I guess I won't be buying that.
It also loses Rough Trade's Shakedown, the best needle drop in the entire movie. Like, it's just, I don't know why they changed it, but it just feels like William Friedkin went in and tinkered with it for this release, and you know, that bums me out. Anyway, remake, redo, prestige series. What are we thinking with To Live and Die in LA?
Well, I know what I would do for a remake, but I do want to mention the Exorcist TV series that you, I think it was ABC, is Hannibal level good. It is the best sequel.
Really?
It is a sequel.
I've never watched it.
You'd love it. It's a full on, like, very well written, low key, intelligent sequel to the movie.
Okay.
To the first movie. And it also, in a very Friedkin way, starts in an international setting. They have a new version of, it's a mixture of Karras and Marin. And he's this British guy who is tortured, and he kids have died under his care when he was trying to save them from, he's a true exorcist. And it fucking works. And it's back in, I think it's back in Georgetown.
I'm a true exorcist. Did you know that?
I did know that.
Well, I exercise that ass.
I was going to exactly say the same thing. But Gina Davis is the lead, and Alan Rook is like, and her husband has dementia. And it's just, there's a lot going on, and it really, really, really works. But I would say in the mindset of remaking a film that needs to be remade, I think that Guardian would be a good, like, remake a movie that could actually do, I like the idea.
Yeah,
and from what I've read about it, and
Rampage would be the same way.
I just think where it's like the idea is good. I watched some trailers. I remember when The Guardian came out. It's 1990. So I'm, you know, you and I are 6'7", and they're like, from the director of The Exorcist. Like, they push it so hard.
Killer Trees.
His return to horror, and like, it's a weird, really idiosyncratic movie. Some of it actually really works.
It looks like a DTV movie almost.
It does, but it's weirdly, what if the hand that rocks the cradle had a killer tree? Like, yeah. That's all it is.
That's the best way of describing it.
Yeah, and I actually stole that from Cobweb's channel, this guy Daniel, who I like to follow as well, but he's right, you know, and it is the idea. I'm like, wow, what if you're like, what if we were able to go back to our filmmakers' failed movies? Our favorite. And like, again, like, I want The Keep to eventually happen based on the book. And not to like shit on Michael Mann, because I love the original, but the book is like lush and amazing and in depth. And it's like fucking Indiana Jones. It's great.
Yeah.
And
it's a whole series.
Well, you know, it's the Adversary series by right. Paul Wilson. And like, it's not a series in terms of like those characters, but it's a thematic, you know, connection between big forces of good and evil fighting each other for thousands of years. But I would do The Guardian. I would love it to do like, take what I mean, from what I understand, I guess they really changed a lot when they released the film.
I think so. I think that was taken away from him.
And it's, you watch the film, but like, there's just elements of stuff where it's like, ooh, this is really fucking interesting. And the idea, too, of like being new parents and the fear of your child, like, that always is good for horror.
Yeah. Also, somebody's got to fuck the tree in the new version.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The tree fucking rules in it. I kind of like The Guardian, but I would do a remake of that.
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's terrible, but if you were at Exhumed, and they threw The Guardian in the middle of that 24-hour horror marathon, like, I would totally watch the shit out of it because I'd love to see it on the big screen.
Well, and the gore is really...
It's gross.
Again, you're like, whoa!
Yeah.
You know?
I would probably do a To Live and Die in L.A. series. That would... I mean, that feels like it would work quite a bit.
And almost like a Refn series. Like...
I wasn't going to say Refn, but...
I know what you were thinking.
You could see the twinkle in my eye.
I was like, he's thinking...
It was like, he is
too old to die young.
He's thinking of Nick Refn right now. But I mean, like, too old to die young. I mean, that's so Refn, as people have listened to our multi-part series now. We're the only people out there.
There'll be more Refn to come.
Oh, yeah, I can't wait. Oh, because he's making a new movie right now. So, like...
Well, there we go.
Yeah, so we got to cover that shit. But I'm trying to think what young director I would like to see tackle To Live and Die in L.A. as, like, a multi-part series. Like, imagine if, like, Christian Gudegast made like a To Live and Die in LA series, or like just something kind of low rent and trashy and fun and not necessarily like the elevated version of it.
Hyams.
Hyams would be a ton of fun. You know? Shit. Yeah. Hyams would be a ton of fun. But something like that. Like, I think it would work. Just make it an action series, make it a cop procedural. You know, especially these days when people are looking for that type of thing. Just kind of get wild with it.
He actually would have done very well in that era of like Cinemax and Stars when they were doing stuff like Strike Back, like those like real trashy level, you know, like, or like, or like Spartacus, right? We're going to show the gore and the tits.
Yeah.
You know,
put it on FX.
Yeah.
And just let them run wild.
Absolutely.
Face Melter. Yay. Nay.
I would actually say yay. For To Live and Die in LA.
Again,
I showed it to my partner, and this is not her kind of movie. And she was like phoned down, like my mom with French Connection. She's like, whoa.
It's an intense film, man. Yeah, and it looks incredible. The soundtrack is incredible.
You start with that Wang Chung stuff, and she was like perked up. Like, you know, and I think my mom, again, French Connection, I think he has a propulsive, like, draw you in filmmaking style that is hard to like quantify, right? Like, there's just something about him that, like, when I start one of his movies, I'm not gonna stop it. Like, I've never like watched part of Sorcerer.
No,
I'm just like, and people talk about, oh, it's a really long beginning. It's like the beginning has some of my favorite scenes. I love all the opening stuff.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and then that movie just completely draws you in. Exorcist, same thing. I mean, like, He was, like you said, a born filmmaker and a born storyteller.
Right.
You know?
He just recognizes what works for audiences.
Exactly.
What's thrilling, what's interesting, yep. While also, frankly, elevating it to a certain degree artistically.
Yeah, and realistically, you know, adding that like realistic nature.
Well, Martin, it's great being back recording again.
We're back. We're about to go get some chicken wings.
We're going to go get some chicken wings, brainstorm a couple more episodes coming up. You're going to get a whole lot more of our favorite filmmakers coming up on the next few episodes of Secret Handshake. So stay tuned.
See you then.